Thank you for being here, because I don't, of course, know any of you personally, so I have to sort of get a gauge on your faces. My sister Helen is here, and that's always nice to see one beloved face out there. But last night I was just introducing three poets, exactly as you just introduced me, giving thanks to the donors and the people in charge. And the three poets I introduced were very young and wonderful, Sandra and Ben Dollar and Srikanth Reddy, who's written a very good book called Voyager. And so we had earlier had a Q&A at Georgetown, too, where the conversation went somehow very quickly to the subject of form, which seems to be sort of a fretful subject right now. And Srikanth, who calls himself Chiku, was particularly articulate about the subject of form and how troubling and how paralyzing it is for him that to find the shape for all the notes he takes. And so that made me think about just the post-millennium generation of poets following out of the language period and John Ashbery and what's going to happen now and how complicated that must be for young people. And so that was one thing I wondered if some of you would want to talk to me about today, or the book, The Winter Sun, which is semi-autobiographical, but it's an attempt to do a new kind of essay, which I'm getting more and more comfortable with. And someone like Ann Carson was the great pioneer of that. But I think all of us are wrestling with this form issue now, between what comes between things and how can we follow on things. And, of course, I'm now in the end days. And so I have a different sort of look on it from someone of under 40. That's what I was calling these poets last night, and remembering we used to say never trust anyone over 40. And so I was very moved by this conversation about how troubling that is, the whole form issue. And I don't know whether there's a presiding kind of aesthetic in the poetry program here. So that's what I wondered, because certain places, you know, are very committed to experiment and others to much more formal poetry. And so I wasn't clear here what you would, I might even ask you a question, what you would say as younger writers about that issue. I mean, it really interests me about whether it's one teacher or whether it's a poet from my generation, or if you're influenced by the younger group of poets like Peter Gizzi and people who are now maybe in their mid-40s to mid-50s. And I'm just very sort of concerned about the questions of the way poetry can be taught, which is to pluck pieces of other people's work out and insert it into your own poem to sort of elevate the language, and whether that's ethically good for you to do, what it does to you. I don't care about the line of the poem, but what it does to the person writing poetry to keep pulling and sticking things in and constructing poems out of other people's suffering, let's say, people's really hard worked poems. The only thing is, then I heard these three poets last night who all do that, and they all were fantastic. I mean, hearing the work was totally great and very different from reading it on the page. So that's another issue too, is poetry as a score for music, the music of speaking it out loud in public, or poetry as just a written private relationship. So that those were questions that are just really in my mind today because of yesterday and many times before. So. Yes.
Actually, I'm interested in the essay form. There's a lot of lyric essays are being written now.
Lyric essays. And I'm thinking, you know, there's essay press, which is also kind of messing around with how the essay is produced. So I guess from your perspective, and you said you were playing around with the essay form in Winter Sun, and so I'm interested in kind of I am interested in the perspective you have as far as, you know, where it's been coming from. You know, Ann Carson, certainly that seems a good place to start. But, you know, there's the grand piano stuff, too, is also what I'm thinking of. So, I mean, it seems like a lot of approaches. So I guess, what do you think?
I think it's definitely something that's in process now, generally speaking, and it's like so much right now. That's the problem. We're in this sort of information age technology boom, and we really don't know where it's going to lead. So everything is in this transitional mode, and I think these formal questions definitely have to be conscious of that mystery of what's going to happen to words and how is expression going to take form. So for me, I'm really like a late Victorian writer, and so what my instinct is lyrical and from something that has an echo from my childhood, really. And I've been very sort of overly obsessed with World War II and the Cold War and history and that whole period, and trying to shuck that. I mean, literally, very deliberately trying to stop brooding over the 20th century. And so for me, that kind of playing with pleasure, with the pleasure of writing, of moving everything around and shaping it, is like an attempt to move out of something heavy for me, which was the 20th century, really. In a nutshell, it seems for me it's got a lightness. It allows for me to change my mood in the middle and to, but I had one central idea running through the whole thing, but of course I didn't know I had it until it was done, and so for me the. Real work was in the formation of those blocks and how they would balance together, just sort of looking at it that way.
I wonder if you could say something about how your sense of vocation as a poet has changed or not changed through the years.
Oh, I think it probably has changed along with everything else. Just self-knowledge. And I used to do it with complete spontaneity. And I've been very lucky in that I don't ever think of an audience or anything. I just do what I want very willfully. And I still do that. So it's all me and it. And so that's always been sort of a liberating position to have. And in that sense, that hasn't changed. But I think my sense of kind of weights has changed, where the weights go now. I mean, it was much lighter once.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I was wondering if you could speak about contemporary poetry, specifically conceptual poetry, and this trend now of including other people's work without giving any credit, just, you know, making it part of the poem.
Well, it's part of a general thing called sampling, which, you know, is part of the entire culture. It's not just poets doing that. It is a kind of ironic relationship to language and a distanced relationship to it. So it's used as material rather than personal expression. It's very much coming out of the sort of Marxist documents. Pages are just there, materials to be moved around. And so I don't judge it. I mean, it to me is completely natural for this environment when everybody's archiving and studying and feeling skeptical. I can see why that would happen. But I think it's, as I was just saying, I think it's very much a transitional thing. I don't think it's formed something importantly new yet. I do think the language poets were really important. I would never not say that. They were really important to the sort of ennui that was in American poetry for a long time. And they broke that up. And so that everybody has to think about them.
I'm going to go back to the weight.
Yeah.
When you were talking about the weight and how that shifted for you, and that you mentioned that you shuck the 20th century, you're attempting to shuck a lot of the baggage or the weight
right.
of the 20th century, but yet your weight is going in different areas now, and so I wondered, where is it going? Where is the weight going? Is it going into content? Is it going into, because you can use so many forms, essay, poetry, writing. How is it in your own mind distributing now?
Well, now it is more I read more philosophy now than I would read ever before. And so I'm more thoughtful, I guess, in that sense, and not so, I guess, you know, in the beginning, your body and your poems are the same thing. Now I'm much more in my mind, and that's probably a natural aging thing.
In relation to what you just said about philosophically, I have long admired and been intrigued by your treatment and your theories of time. Would you mind talking about that just a little bit?
Yeah, it mostly came out of actual experience, physical experience, almost like being struck, seized by a sense of, and I'm sure it's partly because of Einstein's theory of relativity and the slow way that we process information from the sciences. It takes forever for you to actually really understand, and then one day it does. And that was sort of it. I was walking along a river with my dog, and I suddenly realized I was walking on the past. I was walking, in other words, permanently in space, and there was no past or future. And it was like sort of terrifying, actually, for that moment. But then I tried to make sense of it, and that sort of became a kind of triggering moment for the way I also began to write lines and put words on paper was in that kind of suspended state. But it's very hard to reproduce, probably impossible. I think Leslie Scalapino, I don't know if any of you know her work, but I would say she was permanently in that state of mind, trying to find a permanent present by bracketing and doing all the things she did.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference in process between writing essays and writing poems?
I wrote loads of novels when, and they're all, five of them are in a collection called Radical Love, five of my novels that I ended writing in 2000, but they were becoming more and more sort of essayistic. I'd suddenly start having a monologue in the middle. And so I sort of naturally moved from fiction more than from poetry into writing these essays. And then because I write poems sort of all the time, you know, I'm just jotting them down and listening to sounds all the time, it just inevitably became almost like they're the same thing to me now, writing prose and writing a poem. Yes.
So you mentioned your obsession with World War II, and I was also thinking of your latest book and how you begin it with a quote by Ceylon. And I'm wondering what your relationship is with or to his work, or how he influenced your work, and maybe what that quote, what was the relationship you intended maybe between that quote and that book?
Well, I think he's so broken, and then he makes the best of being broken. And so that was, he's sort of a model for some things I've been saying already of taking, trying to get beyond, using language to try to heal and get beyond whatever the original trauma was, and then not succeeding at it. So I'm sort of interested in failure and looking at failure, and I think he's a really great example of failure, of the beauty of failure.
I have a question kind of stemming from that. You talk in Come and See, the essay Come and See, about how you discuss how poetry itself is survival itself, and you just mentioned finding that sort of the beauty and failure through language. I just was interested in what your relationship to language is at this point after writing that essay.
Oh, after writing that, it changed a lot. Well, really what changed it was from 2000 to 2007, I was involved in translating some poems from the woman I mentioned in that essay, Ilona Carmel, and her sister, who were in labor camps and ended up in Buchenwald, but they both survived. Anyway, I spent 7 years on adapting the poems they wrote in the labor camps in Polish with the help of Polish translators. But somehow that process of translation was much more of a real experience than I had anticipated. I thought I was just going to do that, you know, sort of say this looks like this. But it turned into grueling, really like digging a garden and digging and digging and digging until there's nothing there. So it was, I think translation can really change a writer, and it's a great thing to do, but it can be harrowing, depending, you know, it can be really harrowing, because you often can't find the person. Is there a person there? Yes.
I heard a interview between you and a fellow named Ruas.
Oh my God, years ago.
It just many years ago?
Yeah.
Well, I hope this is not too late to ask question.
It's too late for me to remember, I'm sure.
Well, one of the things he mentioned, you both were talking about this French mystic, Simone Weil, and I looked into her philosophy and some of the things that she said. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how she inspired you, or what was it about her? Some of the things she said were so radical and so difficult to achieve, and she herself fell victim, I guess you could say that, and that she died sick and starving. I wonder if you could address that.
Yes, well, she was like the major person, the thinker for me, and all she really did was write a lot of notebooks. And I love Camus' notebooks, and I love her notebooks. They're in the same period, again, back in that 40s. But she was, like, afflicted with genius. I mean, she had terrible headaches, and she couldn't adjust socially to anything, and she wrote these. She was trying to break through to have belief. And she was she was too skeptical, too profoundly skeptical, to have the belief she wanted to have, longed for. But she explored that problem better than anyone else of how you can't force it. You either, it's a gift, I guess, to have faith. And she to me, that was sort of, if in a nutshell, what's fascinating about her journals is how deeply she explores that.
One of the things that was quoted that she said was, in order to have understanding and faith, you have to hit your head against the wall so hard that you fall unconscious. And when you recover, you resume hitting your head against the wall. And then she said, perhaps ultimately, you'll find yourself on the other side of the wall. And I thought that was beautifully said, but painful to read.
That's it. Exactly. It's a perfect example of what I was saying. Perfect example. So why did I love her?
why did you love her?
I think there's something so... first of all, as a writer, she writes like Camus. She has that beautiful that French mid-20th century style, which is just perfect and easy to translate. So it's just wonderful to read her, but also because of the intense seriousness of her occupation. So that was, and it was rare to find a woman like that.
Maybe you can explain this to me from your earlier remarks. I don't know whether you're familiar with the rock lyricist Ray Davies, but one of his songs is, I'm a 20th century man, but I don't want to die here. I think that the 20th century will probably require endless processing. It certainly was an incredible period of time. I wonder why you feel an urgency or a necessity to move out of that contemplative practice into something post-millennial.
Because I think it's gotten up to be too heavy, and that it's also affecting the way people who are like me, who are too turned in that direction, write, that it isn't good for writing. I believe that in sort of poetry is something that is continually trying to be expressed in a million ways, and I don't think it's good to be too nostalgic and too angry for poetry. But I mean, I think it was just so perfected by Walter Benjamin. I mean, he said everything there was to say. So now it's up to us to go along after that. There's got to be something after that.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk maybe first about some of the reasons why you think that's occurring now, and if it's being mirrored, or is it mirroring an earlier time in literature when that happened?
I doubt that it ever happened before. I think it has to do with excess information and an abundance of people trying out things. I mean, I just think it's a mass phenomenon. We have a new kind of population in the world. So I can't imagine it could have ever happened before.
Can we then be a bit more specific about that? So, because I guess I'm thinking that some of the sampling, some of the collaging, maybe some of these things have happened before in modern poetry. And I'm trying to discern the differences between some of these things that happened earlier and what's specific about what's happening now that's, you know, different, not necessarily new or anything. I'm just trying to, for myself, discern it.
Well, I think it's different because it's all part of a new culture, which is music and poetry and movies. I mean, they're all like one phenomenon now. And they weren't when T.S. Eliot was, or Marianne Moore were using references. It's music is really the great art form now, and so is film. So, but they're poetry too, as far as, you know.
So it's related to sources.
It is. It's related, yeah, and to the whole environment. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
Still worried, this is about younger poets.
Okay.
So I'm thinking about how you just introduced those three younger poets. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I've read a lot of books recently that were contest winners that you selected. And I feel like you have a very active role in the engagement and the furthering of young poets. I don't want to say careers because that's an awful word, but in our knowledge of who's writing now and what they're doing. And so my question is, what in the newer generation of poets do you see as the most exciting thing that's happening, or the most, maybe the newest? And I think that's related to the last question. What's the new thing that you're so excited about?
Well, I suppose the cross-genre thing, where people are bringing narrative back into poetry. So I think that's really exciting. And also, I like the way languages from other cultures who have become Americans are influencing the sounds. And so, I mean, I've just read, I don't remember his name, but a young Indian poet who was using all the beautiful names from India in his sentences, which were otherwise completely American. And so it was fusion, you know. It was, and I guess that's what I am interested in now, is how that's being done.
You mentioned the word narrative, which I was thinking about as you were talking, and I wonder if you could, is there a new narrative? Is our society so disjunct that there is no narrative? And I'm speaking of narrative here in the terms of story. And I was just curious your thoughts about a new narrative or a disjunct narrative or no narrative at all.
Well, I think all the great narratives are on HBO and AMC. I mean, those are the ones we all care about, what's happening. And so they're alive and well, but they've just taken another shape. I just don't know about if people have the mental, the time to sit and read novels anymore, but... HBO. Well, that's what's emerging now is these sort of fragmented narratives. Dawn Lundy Martin, does anybody know? She's a wonderful writer. Oh, she's just great, and her book Discipline is great. And that's a kind of narrative that's fragmented, but you get the whole picture, believe me, by the end. So. That's what I think is really exciting. And partly because it's short, it is influenced by film, so there are short scenes. And the responsibility now of young fiction writers is to be very, very painterly, very specific about what objects they put, like the old fairy tales used to be, you know, that there were like four things that keep recurring. And that we have to sort of go back to that, but in a new way.
Could you talk a little bit about how narrative informs the new essays that you've been writing?
Well, who am I talking to? Did you say that? Yeah. It was, I think it's because I just have that impulse from writing all those novels for children and everything. I wrote a lot of young adult novels. So I just feel that impulse. It's part of my psyche.
But does, do you have, how does the, like, you know, you're talking about how HBO and those are the narratives that we like nowadays. How do you deal with that in writing? Or how do you try to, like, live up to that? Or do you?
I don't. But I do, I like movies better than anything in the world. And I do find I am influenced by the way scenes are framed. But probably in a more abstract way. Yeah.
Hi. You talked about shucking the 20th century and World War II in particular because...
Shucking? No, I'm just laughing.
Chucking?
No.
Because it had gotten too heavy. And I guess this addresses more you as a political figure. I'm wondering if the post-millennium or 21st century wars, Iraq and Sudan and all the uprisings that are going on in that area, but other places, if that is coming into your work at all.
It does. It way over infiltrates them, I think. But it does, definitely, yeah. It's impossible not to have that in your body after you've read the Huffington Post and went, you know.
Yeah.
It's all there.
Yeah. So do you see that as a substitute for the World War II angst?
Are all
the same?
Oh, and that's a good question. Well, it wouldn't be something I would want to have. So I don't think it would be a substitute. I think it's just an inevitable influence, is that presence of that we all feel. Of violence, unnecessary violence.
Then how is it different from your relationship with World War II? And, you know, isn't it also equally heavy? And
it's equally heavy. But it's the difference is that that was the invention of large-scale war from World War I
right
up to Hiroshima. You know, it was all mass technology working in a violent, horrifying way. So that was the first time to ever see it like that. Now it's just appalling. It's the drones, all of it. It's just beyond.
Well, the Hutu and Tutsis and how they used mallets or...
Machetes.
And, you know, that was interesting going back to, you know, a very... very basic weapon.
Right. But look at Sarajevo.
Mm-hmm.
So it's everywhere.
Yeah.
The basic.
So going back to basics.
Yeah, right.
In war.
Oh, in light of all the heavy awareness that the writer sits down with when she's at her desk, what do you think is the function of the poet in the world?
I think the great thing is it has no function at all. I think that's the beauty of it. It's absolutely useless. And it's, but I really believe that poetry is everywhere. It's in the room now with us. It's walking down the street out there. I believe in poetry as a phenomenon structurally underlying everything we do. So it's bound to want to get out. And that's the only way I think of it. I don't think it has any function otherwise. Except
not even subliminally?
I don't know, really. After all this, I wouldn't be sure.
after all the work that you've put in and the years and the books and the teaching and the lectures and the conversations, isn't it the case that the moral fiber of your being is expressing itself to some moral vibration among us? Am I just a fool hoping
as I said, I believe there is a poetic structure everywhere. And so to become conscious of that and to teach how to become conscious of that is important, but not in a functional sense. You know, it's more to be happy.
Are there poets that you started with that were influential to you when you first started writing that you've never left, that you've always returned to, and that you still return to, who remain important to you?
Yes, Thomas Hardy is one. And then I loved early Celtic and Chinese poetry. And I, for some reason, have always liked poetry in translation, so I like that strange tone of the translator, even when it's bad, you know, when it's all too much or something. I think it's seductive and interesting. So I've read Baudelaire. I keep going back to the French surrealists. And yeah, I love that period very much. And Frank O'Hara.
What do you think? So I'm curious what you think the job is, or the responsibility of the young poet is. What do the young poets need to attend to? Is it violence, or is it?
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, you should probably notice.
Or should we? Do you think there's?
I think it's your job to notice that injustice. And to remark on it, you've got to include that. So it's that's as much everywhere as this spirit of poetry I'm talking about. There is the big giant things are all being acted out every minute, everywhere, on buses and on, you know, anywhere you go, you can see the imbalances and how unfair things are. So I think that has to be always in the context of your consciousness, really, that you can't just leave it behind, or it would just be a fantasy. Now, we've run out of steam here.
Hypothetical. What would life be like for you if you unplugged your television set?
It would be desolate.
I find interesting when you're talking about the narratives and these narratives. And yet, in your poetry, narrative is something that I would think of in terms more of the contemporary, as far as, you know, the fragmentation, the sort of more postmodern rather than late Victorian move of narrative. So, I mean, it's in, how do you reconcile, I guess, that? Or is it just fine, like, you know, this is a place not for narrative, or it's okay, or whenever it comes in, that kind of thing?
I don't even think I know that I'm being postmodern. Or, I mean, I think I really just am listening all the time to the way people talk and things drift off in completion in words. I mean, I really do love the way people talk to each other. That interests me a lot, just to be alert. But so I'm sort of recording, but I don't ever think I'm part of some movement at all. I wish I did, but I don't.
Well, I guess in, you know, narrative is something that would be structured and thought about and,
yeah.
and created in, say, a novel or through the essay or something like that. But in poetry, there seem, you know, that's just sort of a contemporary vibe, right? You can kind of meander. You don't have to structure in the same way you would a fictional narrative or a non-fictional narrative, something like that. So those are very different modes, I guess.
They are. But even in my fiction, I was very strange. So I think structure, cramming things into a structure has never been the way I did worked anyway. And I never had a... I only have a high school degree. I never had workshops or anything. So it's just a wild thing, just as right.
I imagine you've been through many Q&As. Is there a question you long to be asked that nobody's ever come up with?
Do you want a drink?
That's my question. Do you want a drink?
Yes.
Hi. I had the privilege of hearing you read at UC Berkeley, I think, maybe like 6 years ago now,
right,
or more.
With Lynn Hajinian, yes. Introduced me, yeah.
Yeah, and I asked you then if you thought there was a correlation between certitude and evil, and you said yes, there is. I think
yes.
One makes the other. So to sort of piggyback on that, I've been thinking a lot lately about Keats' notion of negative capability and, you know, not irritably grasping after fact and reason, and maybe that is like reaching for certitude. And I guess I don't have a real question, but I wonder if you have anything to say about any of that.
I think I still believe the same thing, that the dangerous people are the ones who are full of certainty. But I'm sure a million people have said that too. And the Keats thing reminds me a little bit of the way I'm thinking now about failure. And so not as a negative thing, not as a negative part of the world, but as something very real and kind of has its own honor.
Beckett has a favorite quote of mine about failure. Try again, fail again, fail better.
Yeah, there we are.
So since this idea of failure is coming back up again, and the concept of the beauty of failure, and I'm sitting here thinking about how long you have written, all you have written, and with the idea of beauty of failure, but then I got to think of, no, what will she be writing next and in the future, and the beauty, the idea of the concept of the beauty of failure to what you will be writing. And then I got back to the present, since you mentioned that, and this whole idea of the beauty of failure in your writing and how you deal with that, what you think about your own writing in those terms, the beauty of failure, the beauty of it, the failure of it, how they go together. Just some thoughts on that.
Well, partly because I've just begun to think about this kind of failure as a real interesting phenomenon. Not being a loser, but something else. The way it's sort of like entropy. I mean, it's built in failure. And so I do, I guess partly because of aging, and let's just face it, you do begin to fail. And so I'm seeing it now more. I'm more aware of it in gestures and in what happens around me and politically and everywhere, that there is this phenomenon of failure, which is good when it often is very good to see it happen. Because in a way, if nothing works, then What a relief. Nothing works.
So when we write, I'll just put it in the Lee now, when we write and when we fail, there can still be a beauty in that, I think, and I'm thinking that that's kind of what you're referring to. But I'm also knowing that you're referring to the old traumas, the things that have happened previously. And I heard you say that we can never quite get over that, and I agree. But we try. We try so hard. But there is beauty in that failure of not being able to get over that or not being able to write what we would love to write or what we think would be wonderful to write or what would really make us happy to write. But there's happiness in this. I heard you say that.
Yeah, no, there is. There is. There's happiness just, first of all, being alive at all. But then I think the trauma thing is very interesting because most people have one central thing that happens in their life and everything after that is swirling around it. And it's very, you can't ever resolve that, whatever it was, that event. And so you're like in a tide pool forever knocking up against the same things over and over again. But then it begins to form its own order around that. And that's sort of powerful to realize that that's what's happened. So then that hole or that space there becomes, has its own mystery and force. And rather than trying to solve it endlessly, just let it be. Let everything take shape around it.
I think we have time for just one more question. Yeah. Who's it going to be?
I have a question about the book cover on your latest book, Come and See, because I know you had control over that. Can you kind of just talk about that process and, you know, how you came up with this concept? And I'm just really interested in, you know, the way that you shaped it, and it's really beautiful and perfect, I think. So.
It's an incredible picture. Yeah. Well, I was at a place in Italy, a retreat for artists, and this young woman was there who does video installation and all kinds of installations all over Southeast Asia, and she's very well known there, and she showed us on a video, and I saw this, and I said, it just says it all for me. So I asked her if I could have it for the cover, and then it became so prominent as an image of, each of those little dangling things are pieces of glass with blood in them from the people she was staying with in Cuba. It's a very deep political messages in it. But for me, it also is kind of beautiful because it's the bad suspended like that. It's so weird and surreal. So yeah, I was hoping to hit that note in the book. Yeah.
Fanny, thank you so much for talking with us tonight.
Thank you. Thanks. Great question.
And thank you. Thank you all for your really, really great questions. You are a fabulous audience tonight. And please come back tomorrow, 7 o'clock here and hear Fanny read and buy a book tonight. She'll be happy to sign. Okay. See you soon.